Welcome back to Compliments to the Chef. I'm your host, Nancy.
And I'm your host, Bits.
And we have arrived at the episode of the season.
Restaurant Wars.
Restaurant Wars. I should say that last week we recorded at 7 a.m. It is 9 a.m. this week. So I hope that the 2 hours have really not affected our ability to podcast. I did not do my chronotype or whatever it was called.
Oh, yeah. Oy. Got to reheat Do I just Google that next week? We'll talk. It's okay. Like a bit of a process, but I get it from my Oura Ring. This chronotype furnished by Oura Ring.
Oh, okay. Cool. Well, we do actually have one leftover from last week, which is we were inquiring as to the cleanliness of the water in Niagara Falls.
Potability.
Yes, because as we saw, our chefs just got pummeled by that water, and we were thinking, like, is that safe? Is that clean? Because, you know, the Hudson is just disgustingly polluted. I would never touch it with my right toe. And so here's what I found on the matter. Yes, the water at Niagara Falls is fresh water. It originates from the Great Lakes, and it drains into Lake Ontario. It contains about 18% of the world's freshwater supply, which is insane. And it is graded safe, clean, and meets and exceeds all local, state, and federal drinking water health standards.
Yum. Take a dip.
Take a glug. Take a drink. Take a sip, I think was the word I was looking for, but I got there eventually.
Take a glug.
Take a glug.
I don't know. I think you're taking... Glug is the right word if I'm drinking Niagara Falls water.
I mean, you see how wet they got? They were like doused.
Yeah, they were taking a sip and they weren't even trying.
But anyway, so that is our leftover for the week. Not total potluck, but tiny potluck. We've had a few friends just write us in our DMs about funny things that they saw in the episode. We love hearing it. Keep DMing us. And follow us on Instagram at @compliments_to_the_chef_pod. Rate and review us on on Spotify and Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And without further ado, Bits, let's begin.
All right, Nancy, season 22, Restaurant Wars. What is your amuse-bouche reaction?
We made it to the big one. What is my amuse-bouche? Restaurant Wars is kind of always the same, and I don't mean that in an insulting way. Like, it's just always a roller coaster. I don't think I've ever watched a Restaurant Wars and been disappointed, and I have never watched a Restaurant Wars and been surprised. So, in general, my amuse-bouche is... Let's ride. We're here.
Yeah.
What about you?
Amen, brother. That is a very astute observation. I think this Restaurant Wars in particular had a lot of high highs, a lot of high lows, a lot of low lows. I think to me, to take it somewhere squishy and sensitive for a second, I think it was just – I think even – and maybe to make this meta, and what has been really wonderful about this pod is to get to know a lot of these chefs directly on a personal level. And obviously, Tristan had something really personal and awful happen during this week's episode. And, you know, we hear about it when we talk to these chefs that so much of their success comes from the support and the family and the friends that they have around them. And I don't think any of them forget that. And I think it's very core to their story and why they cook. And so it was just a really beautiful thing to witness this week. Mm-hmm. And even among the chefs, just the support there. So just wanted to have a little bit more of a soft amuse-bouche. Yeah. But before we get into the bloodbath.
Well, no, I think that that's true. I mean, I think you raise a good point. I mean, like, I definitely got very emotional this episode, and we'll talk about that more as we get to it. But like a lot of people go on Top Chef and either, I don't know if like miss is the right word in this case, but just like are not able to participate in major life events happening on the outside. And I think like we used to have a jokey prediction category of like most likely to miss the birth of their child, because that's something we've seen a few times on Top Chef, like people missing the birth of their child or people's graduations or people's birthdays. And of course, these are like a sliding scale of level of events. But I think that you raise a good point that I think it's a testament to Top Chef that these people feel that it's like a safe and comfortable environment to stay in. Because like if this were Real Housewives and someone, you know, had a tragedy happen, it would be like, get me the hell out of this nightmare of reality television that I am filling in and let me go live in the real world and be with my family. But I think the fact that we see people willing or like knowingly be on the show while life is sort of happening is a testament to the environment that Top Chef creates, and that like it is somewhere where like you go to succeed and not to be torn down. And it's, you know, a huge opportunity as opposed to like a silly swirl that you like elect to go into.
So 100%. With all that being said, let's get into the food. All right. Restaurant Wars. Yeah. Like you said, I think the reason we love it is the reason we can expect the same thing year over year. No craziness here. The challenge we've got ahead of us is the chefs have to make a 6-dish, 3-course progressive restaurant concept. High level, we've got some guest judges in the mix. Can I just quickly say, these Canadian Top Chef people have the craziest last names. We got Janet Zuccherini, and then we've got Massimo. Thank God we have Massimo, because otherwise we'd be like, who the fuck are these people?
I know.
His level like, Janet of excitement.
Zuccherini!
Zuccherini! Like, it's like his, like, you know, cousin or something. Last week we had Grinch Pan. Just like wild names. And then, of course, for this week, we had Nina Compton back.
Hey!
Who famously from the New Orleans season is a New Orleans chef. Compère Lapin is great if you ever get down there. She also opened a new restaurant recently that I almost went to over Jazz Fest and didn't. So, a little fun anecdote.
You just like you didn't make it there? Was that all?
Yeah, that was it. But, oh, and no, I didn't make it to that one either. We almost went to Charlie's restaurant
from last season,
and then we didn't either. So, yeah, two really good anecdotes for you.
Damn, two swings and misses ending in literally no story at all. You bring nothing to the pod this week.
I've got nothing to bring, but our chef certainly brought a lot. I think everybody brought a lot this week.
Yeah. So this Restaurant Wars was interesting. Something that I noted, and maybe I'm getting too ahead of myself, is that the decor of each restaurant was remarkably similar and lacking.
Okay, we will get there, but okay, I have thoughts on that. And they may be contrary to yours, but also somewhat supportive.
Maybe I'll save it for Judgy Table if we don't get to the exact point I want to make, but yeah, okay. You know what? Sorry, I'm getting way ahead of myself. Let's talk about the two restaurants. So interesting. I think we should talk about the way that these teams were picked, which is by pure knife draw.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. What do you think about this? So I clearly have made my thoughts on the matter known already, but
I liked that this is how they picked the teams. I think that there's always a ton of pressure for the team captains to pick a good team. And then there's also like the really awkward, like, well, I was randomly selected team captain. Does that make me executive chef? Like, there's always that sort of weird dynamic. And so by doing pure knife draw, I think it leveled the playing field in a way we haven't seen in Restaurant Wars in a long time.
I agree. I loved it. Please introduce a little bit of just randomness out of, you know, external locus of control here, because
yes,
I just feel like it ratchets up the anxiety so much. Obviously it's like not as fun because we can't talk about like the strategy behind, you know, the people picking, but let's talk about the folks on each team. So the first restaurant we had, Nona Pipon, was Bailey, Schwei, Cesar, and Paula. Mm-hmm. What do you think of this lineup?
I think that this lineup is super interesting. You have like a really good mix of people who have really pushed the envelope all season in terms of creativity and people who have sort of like stayed true to their lane. Like Bailey, especially when we talked about her on the pod, has talked about like she just wants to do the things that make her happy. And that's all well and good. It has led her to like do a lot of just Italian food. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think that she has not really dipped her toe into like the really insanely innovative waters since she returned. Because I think she's trying to stay true to herself and rock on. And then on the polar opposite end of the spectrum, you have Cesar, King Pickle, who made like the dessert of the century and blew Tom's mind and is willing to really mix things up.
Right.
So I think you have a very interesting spread and balance of traditional and hyper creative chefs on this team. What did you think?
That's a good point. I think it's interesting. I didn't even think about their sort of sensibilities as chefs. I thought much more about their dispositions from like a personality or just general vibe. And this group to me was very chill.
Yes.
You know, this was a group of chillers. And I think that this kind of, and like, that's my like super scientific read. but like, I do think that this maybe had something to do with the fact that their shopping experience was a bit of a mess. Yes. Compared to the other team, because they're like, let's all do it together. Like, that does not surprise me that that's the plan that this group came up with.
Yes.
So we see them pretty early on in the episode when they're like, let's go shopping together. They quickly realize that, oh shit, we have a bunch of other stuff to get at Whole Foods. Like, okay, Bailey, Paola, like, you go ahead and do it. And then they end up losing like an hour and a half almost of cook time. So that to me, I thought, and to zoom out for a minute too, I think that that's something that this episode, and honestly the last couple of episodes have done really well as far as like production and just editing goes, is because they really play both sides of the fences. And so this sort of like chill energy I thought was like, oh, this is going to serve them really well. They're clearly all on the same wavelength. There's good vibes. And then very quickly that flips and it's like, no, they're completely behind schedule. It's kind of a mess.
Yeah.
So that was my read. And now let's compare them to the second group, which is where all the, you know, non-chillers.
This is a team of big personalities. Like, these are the heavy hitters on this team, I would say. Emblematic of which is Massimo coming in so hot with an idea that he has clearly been marinating on, pun intended, for Restaurant Wars his entire career. He just comes out, he's like, okay, bear with me. Six courses, six districts of Toronto or Canada.
No, I thought it was like the evolution of Canadian history.
Yeah, it was like this. Yes, it was like the history of six eras of Canada.
Yeah, and I was like, sir, no one knows anything about Canada. Don't go there.
This
no offense.
Is literally Top Chef America, destination Canada.
We don't even know American history. Please don't ask us to learn Canadian history.
Yeah, and like, I love how Tristan, Vinny, and Lana looked at each other when they were just like, we're going to tacitly agree to not give that any credit.
Thank you for your contribution. Now fuck off. But yeah, you're right. This was all the heavy hitters. And I would say in terms of – and you're right. I think all of these chefs across the board, all eight of them, have a very coherent, clear point of view that we have seen over the season. So I don't think anybody's out here cooking like, what should I make this week? Like, we kind of know what to expect from each of these people when they put a plate on the table. But this group definitely, I think, has less of the energy of like, sure, let's go with your plan. I think everybody would like for everyone else to go with their plan.
Yes.
And
the other, I will add to that, I think that I need to go back and look at what all these people's like positions are and titles are. But I do think that this group has more experience in like very high functioning kitchens.
Yeah.
Like, we know Vinny worked at the Nomad. That's sort of like a mechanic shop in terms of efficiency.
Right.
I think Massimo like is an executive chef at his restaurants, Tristan. And so I think that what's very interesting and something that I have learned about the restaurant world through Top Chef, and I understand this is not rocket science, but you know, I just am a student of all of this. I'm not an expert. Like, there are different levels in the kitchen, the same way there are like different levels of seniority in corporate America. And like, just because you are a very talented cook does not mean you are a very talented executive chef, does not mean you're a very talented restaurateur. Like, these skills are not necessarily transferable. And so it's interesting when you get to a challenge like Restaurant Wars to see how that level of professional experience plays out. And it isn't uniform. Just because you've been in one of these hyper-functioning kitchens doesn't mean you're necessarily going to have a great Restaurant Wars, but it just manifests itself differently in different team dynamics. And people's strengths and weaknesses come out to play in different ways.
Yes. Yep. 100%. Let's so to state it outright, Tristan, Lana, Massimo, and Vinny make up Flora and Fauna. Did you or did you not think of that meme with the dog that says Steven? You know, like that whole thing where like people go to Starbucks and they like the like baristas spell their name wrong on the cup. Like they'll be like, oh, my name is Steven with a PH, and then they'll write like PH.
Yes.
T-E-V-E-N. So that was
Flora and Fauna. I did not understand why it had to be PH. Did they explain that?
Why? I thought they did, and then I didn't know.
I rewound it, and I was like, I think they just thought it was clever from a spelling front.
I will say that like Flora PH is cool. Fauna PH is like doing something funny to me. Fauna. Flora and Fauna. So let's now talk about who led our sort of like executive team, our leadership group, as you will. So staying with Flower and Fauna, Tristan ends up and I think that this is like completely made sense to me. He ends up executive chef. He does have immunity this episode. And Massimo ends up in front of house. Again, no surprise to me.
Like, yeah,
we knew really gonna let this guy make it to Restaurant Wars and he's not gonna be front of house. Like, okay.
I also love how Lana, like, they ended up flipping a coin for it or rock, paper, scissor. And Lana, like, when Massimo won, was just like, all right, dude, I'm not gonna die on this hill. Like, you go for it.
Yeah, that was she did well to kind of like back away from that one.
Yes.
Oh, brother. Okay, well, so. Let's see.
On the Nona Pipon side, we have Paula stepping up to be executive chef. I'm going to be honest. I was surprised.
I was surprised by this too. I think maybe there seemed to be sort of a reason that now I'm kind of missing it. But yeah, no, I think it was just really – I was kind of surprised Schweib volunteered for front of house too. Both of these picks surprised
me. Yeah.
You're looking at a group of chillers. I don't know who else I would have picked for either. I think anyone would have been a surprise.
I was surprised that Schweib didn't go for executive chef. I'll be honest.
Yeah.
I just like – I don't know – I mean, maybe we just have a totally different read of his personality based on the edit, but I was surprised that he didn't want to do the heavy lifting in the kitchen. He seems like someone who really likes to run a kitchen. Mm-hmm. And Paula, this is absolutely not a dig. It's more just like, I don't think we've seen her take on a leadership role in any of the challenges so far. So maybe her logic was like, I haven't really had a moment to showcase myself. Like, now's the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we just haven't seen her in this role. And I'm going to be honest, like, I think that she did a good job as executive chef.
I think she's got, like, the right disposition for it. And I think that that's, like, kind of, to your point, we haven't really seen the side of her. I think that that's probably what makes her a really great leader, is that she didn't feel the need to, like, shove that in our face all season. And it just sort of is, like, a quiet, natural. I would say the same for, like, honestly, this whole group strikes me as people that probably garner quite a bit of respect in terms of like serving in a leadership capacity because of their sort of disposition, and they're all very different people, but I think just the alchemy of this group made it such that there was like a serenity to this. And I think that Paula's leadership style also just really added to keeping things like,
yes, even she tempered. Set the tone. Yeah. I completely agree.
I will say though, like while we're on the subject of just like the executive chef and expoing, every season this happens when they're doing expo. I would love to just have somebody, maybe a future chef, this is like a shout out, come on this pod and please explain the alien language that is the expo service, because the organization of letters and numbers and words that come out of your mouth to communicate where dishes could go. I'm like, I cannot believe that this is the easiest way to do it. Like, and that there's always a waiter who's like, what? Like, that would be us if we were on this episode. But they always manage to screw it up. And they're like, I can't believe they're screwing it up. I'm like, really? Because it sounds like you just made all of this up like 5 minutes ago and you've asked this person to learn it. It's just fascinating to me.
That is a leftover that I think we need, like, a guest leftover, like an assist. Yes. To explain to us terms that I have heard on television shows all day.
Yes.
We need to know what all day means. And I refuse to Google it. I refuse.
Shan't.
Like, obviously we understand what fire means, but like, we need someone to explain expoing to us and the art form that is. Oh my gosh. I'm excited about who we're going to get to do this.
I'm excited about our completely hypothetical guest.
Okay. Just let that marinate. But let's move on to the concept of each of these restaurants. So we have, as we said, Flora and Fauna, Veg Forward. Nona Pipon is a Latin-Italian mix, which I'm going to be honest, I, like one of the diners, was like, I cannot wrap my head around this concept.
Same. I was like, this actually, I'll state it outright, did not sound good to me.
Yeah, I kind of
agree. It seemed like heavy plus heavy.
Yeah, it's just like...
Heavy plus heavy and like... I think that, like, the flavors of these cuisines are almost too adjacent. Like, with a little bit of tinkering, Italian becomes Latin and vice versa. It's, you know, the sauce, the breading, the meat, the – I don't know. I just think that there's too close for it to be interesting.
Yes.
To pair them.
I agree. I have been to fusions before. There's, like, you know – Japanese Jewish fusion in New York City. There are all these different combinations. And I've seen, you know, like we see a lot of French and like sort of East Asian cuisines. It also comes from like a history of colonization and all these things. But Latin Italian just felt too adjacent to really a concept make. But I did like their aesthetic theme and like the way that they sort of tied it to their grandmas. Like, I thought that was incredibly clever. And I do think it tied it together. And the thing I'll say, and you know, we have to get to the food. Clearly it like worked in the food. Right. I don't know that it was the best food we've ever seen in Restaurant Wars, but I actually think ironically, despite how confusing this concept was to the viewer, perhaps, I think taste-wise and flavor profile-wise, it ended up making sense and they delivered on the concept.
Right, right.
In a clear way. It was not muddied at all.
Yeah. No, yeah, I completely agree. I think that was the meta point made for all chefs, like both concepts was – and this was compared to last year, which I actually think both the restaurants – either both of them or at least one of them kind of like missed the mark on this sort of like narrative through line on the menu, nailing it. So, yeah, and I loved the Grandma Chic. So can we pause and talk aesthetics before we get into the food? Because
– Please.
I really liked the decision. I bet they get, like, what, maybe a couple $1,000 to pick shit out. Like, I think that there's, like, a very narrow window of creativity that can be explored when you're picking out the chinaware and the weird logo for your restaurants. I thought it was nice that they went a decidedly visually distinct direction with the sort of Grandma Chic. It was it was fun and cheeky to me, and I actually thought that of all of the restaurant wards that I can think of in recent memory, it was the most interesting aesthetic choice that has been made.
My first response when we see the warehouse on day two is wicked pink versus green. Like, it was the most atrocious colors of pink and green. Like, I think if they had made that pink a little more pastel And even the green, perhaps a little more woodsy.
Right, right.
I would
right.
have found this a bit more palatable. But I think it was just funny that, like, they are busting their asses. And this is not to say that it isn't, like, incredibly difficult to set up the warehouse. But, like, they walk in the next day and they're like, it looks so good in here. And all that's done is the walls are these, like, hideous shades of color.
Like, yeah, I wonder if they just
did that
for a benefit. It did
not look so good in there.
To, like, know which – I do think some of that is just signposting. You are now in this restaurant. You are now in this restaurant. And I think yes. the same goes for the logo, which, like, we always kind
of
like.
The other thing I'll say, and I am curious about, is the tablescape in both restaurants was incredibly bare. And yeah. when they went to the Restaurant Depot, they had, like, tablecloths and
right.
all these – and linens and all this stuff. And where was all of that?
I don't know. You're
like
right.
It took a lot of time to pick it out. And, yes, they got their plates. Like, it seems like at the end of the day, all they did was pick plates and cutlery. Like, I don't
right.
even, I need to go back and look. I don't even think the chairs were different in these restaurants.
Like, no, it's always that like bamboo, like conference center wedding chair.
Yeah, yes. And the tables were the same. They were those sort of like wood, like rustic-y looking tables in both.
Right.
I just am confused about if they're going to spend a ton of time picking stuff out and take that away from their cooking time. We got to see it in the restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
With
yeah.
the exception
and I don't...
of, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, the only note that I have on the flora and fauna is, man, that logo. This is compliments to the chef, y'all, not compliments to the logo. Because these logos need work. What in the world? Have you ever seen a logo before? Did you just use word art? Come on. Literally contact us. We will design the logos next year. It is
yeah,
crazy
we are
to me.
Professional.
I'm like, did you hear a word that came out of these chefs' mouths in terms of the aesthetic direction here? Because it doesn't look like it.
Honestly, the only thing that would have made the logos acceptable is if they had like a partnership with Canva. Like, that is the only way that those clip art ass logos would make sense.
Oh my God.
What they were bad. They looked like, you know, like at in a food hall or something. They just looked like kitschy, fast casual restaurant logos. They did
they
not
look like when there,
look
there's
like
fine
like dining establishments.
When there is a new sandwich restaurant that has popped up in the strip mall, like in a suburban town, like where I grew up, and they don't have time to like print out a real sign yet, so they just go to Kinko's and they print out like a temporary one and put it on the window. That's what this is giving. Okay, I'm sorry. I like really – we're beating a dead horse here, but like –
No, now that we're done with insults to the logo, we can discuss compliments to the chef.
All right. So let's, Nancy, get into some of the food here. So we've got Nona Pipon and we've got Flora and Fauna. Let's start with Flora and Fauna. We mentioned this at the top of the episode. We won't linger on it. Tristan obviously suffers an incredible tragedy this episode. We see really quickly that he sort of decides to lock in. But this has definitely shifted the perspective and the approach of this team. You can tell that this team is really trying to approach this restaurant wars for him, not to disappoint him. And just to, you know, collectively show up and just do their best work here. So let's talk about what we start to see in the kitchen. Like I said at the top of the conversation, we have three courses. And within each course, we've got two dishes going out. Let's talk about each course. Let's talk about what's going on in the kitchen beforehand. I get, you know, some seasons we get the sort of prep drama happening before the doors open. Sometimes we get it while the doors are open. What's happening in the kitchen, Nancy, for this team in the lead up, during restaurant service? Anything that's jumping out to you?
This team honestly felt pretty on top of their stuff to me. Like, we've seen some teams really fall apart in the prep. I think that neither team... You know, one team was more in the weeds than the other, but we didn't see any like huge disasters in the back of house. Tristan really went out of his way to like talk about how he wanted tickets to be written. And other than that, they seemed to have their prep pretty locked down.
Yeah.
And so what I think that we should maybe focus on in the initial first impression for judges is Massimo in the front of house.
Oh, baby. Overtouched. I actually love the use of this word.
Yes.
We don't hear it till later in the meal, so that was a bit of a spoiler. But yeah, comparatively to what we see in the first group, I guess we kind of are going in reverse order here. But we see Massimo come out, like, waiting at the front door, like, like he's the most excited he's ever been, with champagne in hand for all of the judges. And, you know, is just laying it on thick.
Thick.
And we love it. And I love
like
it.
His hair. Thick.
Thick. Can we take a moment to also, I feel like I'm saying that a lot. There's just a lot to unpack here. I notably for this Restaurant Wars loved the fact that we have returned to all the chefs, or excuse me, all the judges dining together. And yes. None of this like you go here, we go here bullshit. I want to see all these people eat together. Please remove the variable of like, really, you had a great time there. We had a horrible time, which is what we got last season. Mm-hmm. So was very happy to see all of the judges walk into the room together.
Yeah, I will say the counterpoint to that is like, it's really testing the holistic breadth of Restaurant Weeks to have them split up, because it is really testing not just their ability to produce one good meal, but conduct a successful service with consistency.
Yes. So that's a great point.
I agree with you, but I actually think that the splitting up of the judges is a better test of the challenge at hand, which is running a restaurant.
Oh, you've convinced me. I think you're right, actually. I think
you're right. Whoa. Because,
but, you know, but then won't we – it's tough, dude. It's a trade-off, because then it's the – how do you thread the needle on the inconsistencies? Mm-hmm. And maybe that was just a conversation they didn't want to deal with this time around. But, okay, I kind of feel like we should go in the order that the judges experienced Restaurant Wars. So
– okay.
I may actually say let's put a pin in Flora and Fauna and back ourselves up to Nona Pipon, which is where the judges started. So because we talked about Massimo's sort of front of house, let's start with Schwei's front Schwei. Of house.
Nancy, oh, it's just the textbook like traps that you fall into.
Yes.
And here's the thing. There have been 22 seasons of this show. And on almost every single season, one of the front of house people falls into the trap that Schwei falls into, which is like undertouching the judges. And yes. I am so curious, because we, as Monday morning quarterbacks, can sit here and be like, how could you do that? But clearly it is possible if these people who have studied the show and gone on and cooked and made it to Restaurant Wars fall into that trap.
Yeah.
It's clearly not as clean cut as we think it is as viewers.
Yes, 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 yes.
Because you know for sure, Schwei, even if you're not a super fan of the show, Schwei's definitely watched at least season 20 World All-Stars, you know, like.
right.
They've seen a little bit of it. They know what Restaurant Wars is, and they know the cliches. And so I just want to give Schwei a little grace for falling into this trap, because it's possible, even with the best people who have studied the show.
Yeah.
That said, Schwei clearly found one of the wait staff whom he was assigned, who had experience and like trained him to be the head waiter, which is how you would do it at a restaurant.
Right.
But this is not a restaurant. This is Restaurant Wars.
Right.
And you need to give the judges some face time. So Schwei really like relinquishes a lot of his front of house duties to this head waiter. And he does not greet the judges as they come in. He doesn't touch their table. Mm-hmm. I will say the Massimo Neil, I agree, was like a bit familiar. But Schwei, he doesn't come in and say, welcome. This is the concept of our restaurant. He just sort of lets it happen. And the service for the judges is not bad. He's just not present. And that is always something, regardless of how good the food is, that's going to get a comment on during judges table.
Yes. And while he's out on the floor, let's talk about what's going on in the kitchen for Nona Pipon. like we said earlier, they lost a lot of prep time with half of their groceries in the car while Paula and Bailey were finishing up shopping. So, you know, Schwei's in a pinch with his dish. The seafood mm-hmm. was late. And then I think overall, this is something that I'm surprised hasn't been a plot point or a discussion point. We early on in the dinner service see that people are ordering more food than they anticipated.
Yeah.
How, what, like, where did your head go when you heard that? Because I'm trying to unpack that.
I think that this is maybe another front of house issue where it was clearly not explained that this is family style.
Right.
Because if it were, then they wouldn't have all six people at a table ordering individually.
Right, right.
Like, it was never explained all of these dishes will come to you at once.
Right.
And then if it were family style, they, in the back of house, made a mistake to not bring, at least, like, let's start with the arancini, enough for everyone to have one.
Right.
That is an oversight.
One plate of four arancini sitting in the middle of a table of, like, six or eight people. Yeah, I was confused. And I don't know how you put the order in that way. Or, okay, am I getting, like, three plates of arancini? Or, yeah, I don't know. I would have liked to maybe get a little bit more clarity on what the vision – what the ideal vision and ideal sort of front of house scenario, yeah. Like, what should that table be looking like if all went to plan?
Yes. And I think that there was an assumption, like, I think the chefs probably had a really good idea of, like, family style, it'll all be spread out. And I think that that's one piece of information that was not communicated to the servers.
Yeah.
That, you know, I don't even think they realized it was something they were going to have to communicate to the servers. And in retrospect, that really should have been handled.
Right, 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 right. Yeah. And it just was a really funny visual. You have, like, this, like, really tiny square plate with,
yeah,
like,
and they're all looking at it like Hunger Games.
Well, so let's talk about the arancini. So Bailey, let's take it course at a time. So some of these chefs did multiple dishes that came out over different courses. Bailey kicked it off for this team with her chipotle chorizo arancini with tonnato aioli. Personally, not a big arancini fan. I'm not gonna lie, I'll never order it. But
me too.
I think this bite really set this team up for success. I think it was one of the more successful dishes at marrying the sort of mm-hmm. Italian and Latin, like, flavor profile.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on that arancini beyond the visual effect?
I agree. I think that with great luck, she knocked it out of the park on the first dish and made it. This was, once I heard this dish, I was like, okay, I finally understand the combination of these flavors. I think had it not been for Bailey coming out so strong, actually, with these arancini, it may not have been as successfully delivered a concept.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is surprising that a little arancini, I too never order it. I find it's either too dry or it's always like hot as the center of the sun.
Yeah. What am I supposed to take away from it?
I'd rather a croquette.
Yeah. Ooh.
We've done speaking like eight judgy tables.
Speaking of croquette, we got our first aguachile of Restaurant Wars of the season. I don't know where the aguachiles went this year, but they are
The aguachiles have been transferred into tartars.
Oh, right, right, right. We traded in the aguachiles of season 21 for the tartars mm-hmm. of season 22. So Schwei comes out with his frutti di mare with aguachile, and he got zooked big time because Janet Zuccherini did it, and I like it.
Would you rather get zooked or wonked?
Oh, I would rather get wonked.
I'd rather get wonked. Shout out Willy Wonka, the Timothy Chalamet version.
Which Nancy and I saw and we will never forget because we got wonked big time.
We got wonked by that
movie. Like, didn't get it. It's not good. And anybody that thinks it's good, DM us so we can fight about it.
We need to understand why people thought that movie was good.
Yeah.
Moving on to our second course. So we have Cesar with a braised short rib and polenta. Sounds like the short rib was delicious, but the polenta was not the right texture.
Yo, grains are coming for them. Mm-hmm. Just like starches and grains, I think, have been a little bit of a tricky spot.
Yeah.
Short rib sounds so good, though. I kind of knew – I figured Cesar would be locked in on that. Mm-hmm. braised nicely. But yeah, the polenta was a little too tight and the consistency was off-putting. What else did we have going on in this?
We had Bailey's baked pasta.
Oh, deloish. Her issue, there were whole almonds happening, which was strange.
So this was really interesting. And I think that we need to talk about Paula's leadership as executive chef. Bailey, at many points throughout this episode, went out of her way to compliment Paula's leadership as executive chef.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Paula, like, had a rare combination of being a very competent executive chef, but still, like, missing the mark on a few key details. But, like, she was not a train wreck. I think that we really need to emphasize that she excelled in the leadership and managerial aspects of being an executive chef.
Right.
And I think that's where we usually see people really mess up as executive chef. Because they're too focused on their dishes. They're too focused on, like, making sure that their food gets out right and not enough on the holistic experience in the back of the house.
Right.
And this is a moment where Bailey is saying, like, I have a million things going on. And Paula, as an executive chef, recognized that and sort of saved me, took some stuff off my plate. And that's what an executive chef does.
Yeah.
And so you see this interchange between Paula and Bailey where Paula asks Bailey, what is the consistency of the sauce that you want? And Bailey says, chunky.
Mm.
And so Paula, as the executive chef, is like, okay, I'm going to do how the dish is meant to be presented. And unfortunately, and we actually don't know, we don't see a debate between the two of them.
Right.
But we see that that decision right there is what leads to sort of the number one critique of this dish, which is the sauce is too chunky. Almonds in there.
Yeah. Chunky is a tough word to use. Like, it felt maybe like it would be better to kind of decide what, like let's use a sort of agreed upon term, like diced, chopped, minced.
Yes.
But yeah, that was tough. But yeah, is it the process typically that she would be doing a sort of like trial plate and showing that and saying like, this is how I want this thing to look, and then it's a bit more of a, I don't know.
Clearly, maybe. I mean, they clearly didn't have enough time to do things exactly as they would want. But I think that this is just a good example of like, is an executive chef supposed to critique dishes, or is, you know, Bailey sort of gave the direction there?
Yeah.
It's unclear to me.
Yeah.
But I do think, and it has been brought up, I think it's important to note that Paula as an executive chef was skilled.
Yeah. There was like really not a ton of like drama or things that we lingered on with her expoing and executive chefing.
Yep.
Okay. And for their final course, their dessert course. We got dessert from Paula and Cesar. Cesar did a churros with pistachio cream. Paula did a walnut torta de noche with tres leches. Cesar's, I think both of these people had a texture problem.
Mm-hmm.
Cesar's was dense. Paula's texture was weird. And I think both sort of texture-wise ate like a different thing entirely. His was more of a pound cake. Hers was kind of like a biscuit almost. Or maybe I'm getting that wrong.
It was
maybe
sort of like a flourless, nutty cake.
Yeah. And his ate like a biscuit. Hers ate like a pound cake. Right.
I think that they both struggled in the dessert round and did not really deliver anything that the judges felt was like exceptional.
Right.
I will also say just like the colors of these desserts were like pretty beige.
Beige, but that's beige. Like, I was gonna say that's Italian dessert, but no, Italian dessert is almost like scary colors. It's like over colored
a rainbow cookie Italian.
I don't know. Maybe this is okay,
let's move on to Flora and Fauna. So okay, actually the overall feeling at Nona Pipon was it was a well-run restaurant. Like, we didn't really see any major backups in front of house or back of house, which is a testament to good leadership. However, there were some technical errors in the food, and there was a lack of attention in front of house to the judges' table from Shuai. So even though it wasn't chaos, it was not exceptional on either front.
Yep.
And so then we turn our attention to flora and fauna, and we've already covered, you know, Massimo at front of house. But their concept is veg forward.
Got it.
I don't got it, if I'm being honest.
It's whatever. I think it could have been a little bit – it was a little bit of a cop-out.
Yeah. Because it felt like – it feels like veg forward is the new global menu.
You know what I would have liked is, like, meat forward. Just give me meat. Like, literal medieval tavern. You want greens? Go somewhere else.
You will get gout tonight.
Okay, king. Can I bring you any pheasant? No. I agree. It's sort of – you're right. It's, like, global. Yeah. It's nothing.
It's just vegetables, which I love vegetables.
Right.
I am not a vegetable hater. Big veg, don't come for me. But it just, like, what? Because also, there is protein in there.
Right.
I just feel like ever since 11 Madison Park did a fully plant-based menu, everyone's been, like, veg forward in a way that feels a bit disingenuous and sort of a bit unfocused.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay.
I just didn't think it was as interesting as, like, something with more specificity. It's like, yes. It's fine. Like, it clearly came through. So that's great.
Yes. Okay. So let's talk about the first course. We have Tristan and Lana. Something that they did that was really nice was they had each of the chefs come out and explain what their dish was, which we never really see at restaurants.
Yeah. Loved that. Kristen loved that. Yeah. It was just really nice.
And then it led me to wonder. And I can't help but wonder, Carrie Bradshaw.
Can help wonder.
Why don't they do that at restaurants? Like, why? Is it because they're like too in the weeds in the back, probably?
I guess, typically, and they're trying to just like keep things moving. No, I know. Yeah. I was curious about that too. And I really liked that. And I just, again, you know, the Schwein mistake of just nobody introducing the plates was kind of just such a red flag. Okay. So, one thing I will say in the setup sequence where Massimo is, you know, with all of the front of house folks and he's got that tiny little broom sweeping this like massive warehouse space just like with such vigor. It was just a sign of what was to come, which was a lot of Massimo.
A lot of Massimo.
All right. So Tristan kicks it off for this team with the first course. He did a grilled mushroom escovitch, Canadian-based scallop, ajo blanco, and dawa dawa. The other first course here we had was Lana's with was a trout with pot liquor consomme. Yum.
I think both of these got rave reviews. Tristan's dish, subtle and light yet rich and savory, was the direct quote from Zuccherini. And then Lana, they enjoyed the broth. They thought that the raw greens were an unbalanced touch, but the consomme is, quote, stunning.
Yummo. Yeah, I got like mixed signals on this one because at the table, I feel like Nina kind of ragged on it. And then when we got to judge's table, she was like, it was like amazing. It was the best thing I had. I was like, wait, I thought you were just ragging on this thing. Maybe I just misheard, but I don't know.
We'll never know.
Okay.
We'll never know how she really felt about that dish.
But good start. Good start. I think clearly veggie forward. Course two, we had Lana again. She did a truffle potato celery root petit vier. And we had Vinny's first dish, which was Vinny's only dish, a butternut squash confit, grilled pork, and XO sauce. Vinny's looked awesome. I thought, again, we saw the artistry of just the way he handles the ingredient was just really interesting.
Yep.
Best squash I've ever had.
Yeah. What did he do to that squash? Did he sprinkle MSG on it? I have a bag of MSG in my apartment. It's delicious.
Put it on some squash.
Mm-hmm.
It looks really stunning.
It looked delicious. I can't help but wonder, has he made this squash before?
Well, if he did, we sure didn't hear about it. And I don't think we're going to be hearing about it anymore for the rest of this season.
I think he's learned to zip his lip on working at the Nomad. But yeah, so again, both of these dishes, great. They thought that the piece of pork was too big. considering this is a veg forward restaurant, again, I think that goes to the fact that this is a bit of a loose concept that they've come up with. But oh well, it was delicious. And then Lana's, they were really impressed by hers. They thought the dough was slightly raw, but really they're just, you know, picking, splitting hairs. So in general, I think they were really impressed by this.
Another great course.
And then we have a dessert course, which is Massimo's one dish of the night, the corn cremeau blueberry crisp, like the corn ice cream situation. That blueberry crisp looked delicious.
So good. When I first heard his dish described, I was like, oh, Nancy, we got to talk about a crisp versus a crumble. But
me too. Me too. But then
it was very different. It was not a crumble. It was decidedly not a crumble. It was a crisp. So unfortunately, we did not get a crumble there. But where did we get a crumble?
Yes. Do we count chocolate dirt as crumble?
Yeah, I think we do.
Wow. It's incredible how we have achieved mind meld.
We are literally futurists. We should apply this level of prediction to something that's practical and helps society, but we won't.
Or maybe not, it doesn't even have to help society, like something that could make me some more money than I currently make. Maybe I should be a financial modeler.
You probably should. That's the obvious leap from us guessing what chefs will make on this show. Mm-hmm. Tristan came out with a milk chocolate custard with dirt chocolate crumble and a like caramelized parsnip. His looked so cool. I love dirt, by the way. Pudding with dirt is peak dessert for me. I put that in the God tier. I think chocolate pudding with dirt, with like Oreo crumble dirt, gummy worms, and then pavlova are the two most supreme. And then like maybe like a lemon olive oil cake, I think, at the top is the holy trinity of desserts for me.
I love a pavlova with like a passion fruit curd.
Whoa. I like full berry. I like full berry.
Yeah, I like a berry too. My mom makes a delicious pavlova for Passover.
Berries and cream. Berries and cream.
Berries and cream. It should be noted that for those who have listened to this podcast, you may or may not have heard the story of when Bits and I went to the movie theater and she brought an apple and a meatball as our movie snacks. So last night I repaid the favor. Bits and I went to go see Pride and Prejudice, the 20th anniversary, and I brought her chocolate pudding.
It was so good. That was a good chocolate pudding. If Tristan tasted anything like that chocolate pudding, they were in for a treat.
It was Valrhona chocolate pudding from Dishes in Grand Central Market. Highly recommend everyone go eat it. We
a lot of words I've never heard before.
Furnished by pudding.
So they end on a super strong note too. There's a little sherry vinegar in there, which ends up being quite the shining star.
Yeah, I love sherry vinegar.
But on the whole, kind of meta level for flora and fauna, Massimo laid it on a little thick. I agree, like all of the kneeling, I was like, oh man, get out of here. a little overtouched. I think one of the things, you know, to not be like so like, oh, he's like all over here. I do think that the way that Zuccherini put it was really apt, which was that the service just didn't match the food. It was a very upscale restaurant, and it felt a little like homey taverna.
Yes. Yes.
So I think that's reasonable. And I think this they also liked that the chefs came out to present, and it felt cohesive from start to finish. So was the judges table? Let's move to judges table. Was it a surprise to you the way that things shook out? Did you have a good feel for this before we were heading there?
I think it was pretty clear. I think the fact that Flora and Fauna had just kind of a really excellent menu and execution of their food alone was going to be the winning formula for them.
Yeah.
And then on top of it, I do think their front of house was better. Maybe not the Zooks style, but objectively – it's hard to say objectively. But, you know, just a better experience than – what we got in Nona Pipon. So I think that the combination of those two things, it was interesting. We did get like a little vignette of Flora and Fauna having some like backups in the kitchen that we didn't get from Nona Pipon, but they clearly solved it, figured it out. But just, I think the fact that there were really no bad dishes on their team is all you need to know.
Yep. Yeah. And just wow, like such a special moment. Mm-hmm. Tristan takes the win again.
Again.
What a week to take it. That was an emotional moment and it was special. And clearly the team was just, I think that, you know, the money was such an afterthought. Honestly, mm-hmm. the win was such an afterthought. I think that you could tell that they just were glad that they made that group proud.
Yep.
Made it worthwhile. So they finish on top and then let's talk bottom. I'm going to be honest. I was really not sure who was going to go home this episode.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew Bailey was safe.
Mm-hmm.
It really did come down to front of house versus the executive chef here.
As it always does. Quote did the you lovely feel, Gail Simmons.
What did you feel about the decision? I mean, this one was clearly debated between Shy and Paula.
At the end of the day, it was the right decision. I think that there is no doubt that we can critique Schwai's performance. But I think when it comes to Top Chef, at the end of the day, it's about the food.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Paula, despite being an excellent leader, and clearly, you know, they were in the weeds, but they made it through the service and there were no major hiccups. That is an accomplishment in and of itself. But at the end of the day, it's about – with all of these elements and with all this going on, can you make a good meal? And I think their meal was, you know, came in second to Flora and Fauna. And who's accountable for the meal? The executive chef.
Yep. Yeah. I think I would have accepted either result. But yeah, it is it was a bummer. And I know, it's funny. I watched this episode before Nancy did, and you had a bit of a prediction going into it, and your prediction was not right.
My prediction was wrong, primarily because, as I said, I did not expect Paula to step up to the plate of executive chef.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so here we are. You know what? I actually need to add something to I do think that it has to be noted that Schwai's dish was – you know, they had a lot of notes on Schwai's dish. So actually, I forgot that that was part of the judging, or I forgot that aspect of the judging. And that made it a little more gray around who they would send home. Because Schwai's performance in front of house was not the best, and his dish was not the best.
Yeah.
I think Paula's performance as executive chef was excellent, but the food was not.
Yes, right.
And so are we holding her accountable for all of the food? Or are we holding Schwai accountable for front of house and his dish?
Well, but the thing is, I think Paula made the agua chile.
Together. And Cesar did say like that needs more lime.
Yeah. I see where we ended up. I see why we ended up here. Paula's walnut torta with tres leches. Would you eat that? Oh, I guess Denochi is walnut. I'm being repetitive in saying that.
Yeah. I think maybe we should do a Nona Pipon, would you eat there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, me too. I'm just curious, like, what this food tastes like. I still don't totally understand it.
I want to be amongst the general splendor of the pink walls.
Oh.
Great restaurant war.
Great restaurant wars. I'm going to be honest. I feel like we've done a lot of judgy tables this episode.
I have one.
You do? Okay. Yeah. Bits, love to hear it. Your judgy table starts now.
I may have done this one already, but sorry, Italian desserts. I just don't think you're very good.
Yeah.
I don't really like the almond flavor. I feel like there's never enough salt. There's never enough butter. It seems like there is a lot of butter in it, and yet I'm not tasting any of it. Maybe it's just the lack of salt plus butter. But I find it extremely one flavor. And one note. And if you don't like almond, it's a bit of a wash. Sometimes I'll get in the mood for like a biscotti and I'll have that with coffee or tea and that's pretty good. Sometimes like I'll get a cannoli, but I am not reaching for Italian dessert. And so that to me kind of was, I don't know. I do love churros though. I would definitely have a churro. But yeah, Italian desserts, I think they're kind of the worst desserts out there.
I kind of agree. And I like that judgy table and it has inspired a judgy table for me.
Yay!
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Nancy, your judgy table starts now. Ricotta filled pasta. Ricotta can be road paving material when used improperly. When I saw that thick line of ricotta going into the cannelloni, I was like, no, thank you. That shit's just gonna in my mouth. Like, oh my God, I didn't. The amount of tomato sauce you need to counteract that level of ricotta is like a metric ton. I am not interested in a ricotta filled pasta. Don't give it to me. Use it sparingly, and I am done.
Dude, can I add on to that judgy table?
Please.
Which is New York Times recipe for lasagna. Too much damn cheese filling. You guys need to fix that ratio. Way too much ricotta. Way too much cheese. There's not enough salt. So I support you in your aim.
Thank you. I actually take that opinion directly from my father, Mr. Culinary himself. He taught me at a young age when he made lasagna, there's very little ricotta in there. What he does is he takes spinach and he mixes it with just a little bit of ricotta and Parmesan, and like there's just one layer of it.
It's just because enough.
Lasagna drinks sauce. Yes. All of these things I have learned from my father. You need sauce, 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 sauce. And everyone thinks you want a lot of cheese so it's ooey gooey, but that actually turns it into a cement brick.
Yes, it's disgusting.
Yes.
Ugh, now I want lasagna.
Should we do it?
Thanks, Obama.
Well, okay, that is our coverage of Restaurant Wars 2025. We'll see you next year for Restaurant Wars 2026. Don't you worry.
Oh my God, can I just say quick preview to the week ahead?
Yes.
I'm seeing a movie-themed Top Chef week, and you know I just can't wait. Nancy, it's going to be so much fun. It is not a surprise. I am a huge fan of the Mission Impossible franchise, and I think this is going to be so stupid, and I can't wait because the Jurassic World one was next fucking level.
Will we get Joe Flam flying out of a helicopter?
Will we get a celebrity couple who is doomed to divorce? We'll find out next week.
On Compliments to the Chef. Bye.
Bye.